Oh, okay.
My name is Anna Feldman, and I'm the Lay Leadership Chair of the Network. And I'd like to welcome all of you to the first of many, hopefully, of our Affinity Group webinars. I just wanted to let you all know that we're trying to do these Affinity Groups every other month. There will be a variety of topics, and those topics we have developed from last year's conference in Atlanta when we had our lay leadership luncheon, but we would be more than happy to invite any suggestions for us to do them. So now I'd like to introduce Ruben, our executive of the network, and he will introduce our speaker.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna. Before I do so, though, I just want to ask Elisa, who is my colleague here at the network, if there are any general housekeeping she wants to offer in terms of Zoom and the structure of the webinar.
Hi, I just want to remind everyone, if you are joining by phone, if you can please type your name in the chat box so we know who you are. I don't see any just on audio, but just in case. And also if you can mute your phone if you're using your computer audio so we don't have any back interruption from background noises. We're going to utilize the chat box function on the bottom. You can type in questions or comments, and also the Q&A box. Both Ruben and myself will be monitoring them. And we will be sending out the presentation and all applicable files after the webinar. So here's Ruben.
All right. Thank you, Elisa. And thank you again, everybody, for joining us. As Anna mentioned, this is the first of a series of webinars that we will be holding for the Lay Leadership Affinity Group. And it's my pleasure to introduce our presenter for today, Eric Lindauer, who is a member of the network's board of directors. Eric serves as the chair, actually, of our board's governance committee. A bit about Eric's background. Eric is technically now carrying the title of counsel with a firm based in Manhattan, Sullivan and Cromwell, but previously Eric served as a partner in the firm's banking and project finance group. His practice focused on transactional banking, commercial law, reorganizations, and bankruptcy. Eric also has extensive background in the field of nonprofit governance and management, and serves as a member of the board of a nonprofit in Manhattan called the Third Street Music School Settlement, which was a community music school founded in 1894 to serve impoverished immigrants on the Lower East Side of New York. He's also helped to organize and serves as a member of the board of the Good People Fund, which is a nonprofit and also a grant-making foundation that provides financial support and management guidance to small and mid-sized nonprofits headed by dynamic good people who are devoted to tikkun olam, to bettering the world. We are pleased to have Eric with us today, and he is addressing the topic of managing conflicts of interest and related confidentiality issues. And although we've branded this as a Lay Leadership Affinity Group meeting, we do know that this is a topic of interest for CEOs and executives in our network as well. And there are a small number of executives participating today, along with board members. So with that as background, welcome, Eric. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Ruben. I'll ask whether, Ruben, just nod your head, you can hear me okay?
Yep, yeah, I can hear you, all good.
All right, well, I'm very happy to be here. Although I have some experience with Zoom, I think this is the first session of this type. So apologies in advance if we're a little bit clumsy in coordinating questions and comments, but these sessions, as I understand them, are really, you know, an outstanding opportunity to have kind of a collective conversation and share concerns and ideas. And so while I do have a more formal presentation. The goal is really for me to get through that with lots of time so that we can open up the conversation and get reactions, questions, and have a dialogue among all of us. I think maybe a starting point for, you know, sort of how I and the network got to suggesting this as a possible affinity discussion is the fact that, you know, the network itself, as a new organization or a newly reorganized organization, has committed itself to reviewing its own governance with the goal of achieving best practices. And the subject of handling conflicts of interest came up fairly early because our own governance policies and procedures had a conflicts policy that was put into place that was not necessarily customized for the kind of work we do and the kind of board we have. And it didn't seem to really fit the idea of a human services agency with a board that was made up of constituents who routinely deal with the network as sort of not a parent, but as a constituent organization. And so the governance committee tried to take a thoughtful look at our policies, both for conflict and for there are some related confidentiality issues, with the idea of trying to create a better fit. And in light of our best practices pillar, we thought that having thought about it ourselves, we would begin to share our own thinking with others who might benefit from our thoughts. And of course, we ultimately will benefit from yours. Lastly, as a kind of an overview comment, as I'm sure everyone on the phone appreciates, many of these issues are not black and white or bright line issues. We often find ourselves swimming in a sea of gray, which is, you know, one of the reasons this tends to be a topic that people are interested in getting more guidance on. There are some bright lines that I can share, but part of the goal here is to collectively sensitize all of us to some key principles with a view to informing judgments that will have to be made down the road about gray areas. So with that as a bit of an introduction, I do have some slides, which I hope as my, there we go. First, the invitation sent around some supplementary program materials. If you didn't get them, they can be recirculated after the meeting. We have sent around a copy of the recently adopted network conflict of interest policy and the network confidentiality policy. These are living documents. They're subject to ongoing review and change as we all get smarter. We thought it would be helpful to see what we have created for ourselves, and I'll be talking about some things that we put into our policies that may be useful for you all to look at or to see. I will mention that there was a small drafting error, bad cross-reference in the confidentiality policy you received previously. The corrected one will, it's just a defined term, and the corrected one will go around with the follow-up memo to this this meeting. I've included what I consider to be a really good New York State Charities Bureau memo on nonprofit conflicts of interest. Just by way of background, most of what I will be discussing today has general application and general use, but public service announcement. I'm admitted to practice only in New York, in the District of Columbia and the federal courts. I have some knowledge of nonprofit law in other jurisdictions, but there are variants within each state's jurisdiction, and these conversations are not intended to be a replacement for more detailed conversation with lawyers and other experts in your relevant jurisdiction. New York tends to be, or has tried to be in recent years, more on the leading edge of regulating some of these issues. So much of what they're doing should be a good indicator of what's happening more generally in the country. There's a Blue Avocado web article on disinterestedness, and I will speak to that in a little while, but it's a topic that is directly related to conflicts. There's a AICPA model conflict policy, which is a much more detailed policy in terms of defining conflicts than the network, but provides an example of what an accounting firm might say is appropriate for a nonprofit conflict policy. And finally, the IRS's current statement on the purpose of conflicts. I'd like to start really with a quote from the New York State materials. It struck me that New York right off the bat acknowledges that conflicts of interest for board members are almost inevitable in nonprofit corporations, and that the existence of conflicts should not disqualify board service. And the role of a conflicts policy is not to disqualify people from sitting on a board. To the contrary, even the government recognizes that board members who have significant community and business relationships are valuable because of the contacts and expertise they bring to the board. And as a result, they're also more likely to have conflicts that grow out of those relationships. So just as a, as a starting point, none of this is really intended to be about trying to keep people who have conflicts of interest off your respective boards. Instead, it's really about saying, these are some of our best and your best board members. How do we manage that situation? Okay, why should we be thinking about conflicts and the subject of confidentiality? Well, first, we all know that board members owe fiduciary duties to the organization, and I'll come back to that in a little bit more detail, but we all want to meet our duties, and we don't want multiple hats to interfere with meeting with those duties. Conflicts of interest can risk tax-free status with the IRS. It's worth noting, as a practical matter, the IRS doesn't have the personnel or the interest in going out and policing all of this. I think, as we've seen in some recent scandals, this tends to come up only when a nonprofit is otherwise drawn into scandal. And then when negative things are appearing in the press, the IRS jumps in and points out that maybe part of the problem has been caused by lack of attention to conflicts. Individual states, particularly New York, impose their own specific statutory requirements for conflict policies and avoidance. New York in particular, and just by the way, the network, for historic reasons, is a New York not-for-profit corporation. New York State legally requires adoption of a conflict of interest policy, and the statute has certain specific requirements that the conflict policy must address. So one needs to be mindful, regardless of where you are, to keep an eye on whatever state and state attorney general regulates you to make sure you're up to speed on what's required, because the requirements have been changing and getting tougher. Federal and state privacy requirements may apply to confidential board information. And this is, broadly speaking, not just information relating to conflicts, but any kind of private information. And finally, and in my mind, perhaps most importantly for all of us, and this will almost surely come as no surprise to anyone, the mishandling or non-disclosure of conflicts or mishandling of information can seriously damage what is probably all of our single most serious asset, which is the reputation of our agencies with donors, government agencies, membership, and the media. None of us wants to appear in public as falling down on the job in a way that either has compromised private information in embarrassing ways or more importantly, appears to involve self-dealing or other misconduct associated with conflicts. As I said, the goal is to manage, not avoid, the conflicts. And what we are really talking about is trying to adopt best practices to provide for managing the handling of the conflicts. Well, a legitimate first question is, what the heck is a conflict of interest? What are we really talking about here? Well, the bottom line is that in most jurisdictions, there is no single black letter, which is a lawyer's word for saying, a printed law that says, what is a conflict of interest? The IRS says a conflict of interest occurs when an individual's obligation to further the charitable purposes of the organization is at odds with their own financial interests. Note here, the focus is on conflicting financial interests. And this is to some extent a carryover from the for-profit world. And it is probably still the case that both from a statutory perspective and when you ask people to think about conflicts or you look at existing conflict policies, most of them deal with financial conflicts of interest, where a board member has a conflicting interest between their own personal financial interest and some other interest. The New York not-for-profit law actually not only authorizes, but requires the not-for-profits to legally define a conflict in its conflict of interest policy. And if you look at the network conflict policy, you will see that the actual conflict of interest concept that we've adopted sticks pretty closely to the definition or the concept that the IRS has presented. In contrast, if you look at the AICPA example, and you don't have to do it now, I'm just noting that it's there, you will see a much more expansive view of conflicts, one that in today's day and age, I think is much more appropriate, at least for people to be thinking about in managing issues like conflicts, which is to say, in nonprofits, there could be issues or activities that impact the ability of a board member to act in a disinterested fashion and in the best interest of the organization, even if those factors are not themselves the result of something that financially benefits the director. Nonprofit directors often have other complicated relationships with other nonprofit organizations and for-profit entities, which don't necessarily give them personal financial benefits, but could be seen as interfering with their independence. All right, some simple examples, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Sort of the classic conflict that we often think about here is, an agency wishes to engage somebody who's on the board or their family as an employee or a contractor. Most organizations, by law as well as by good policy, already have rules in place to deal with this. And from the person who's being hired's perspective, they will also push you for that, because the law in most states is that if you don't follow the rules with respect to engaging a member of the board or a relative as an employee or contractor, among other things, the contract can be voided. So both sides have an interest in making sure they pay attention to doing it right. Other examples, somebody on your board may just be an officer in a big supplier who supplies the organization with goods or services, or somebody who's a child of a board member applies to a scholarship program that's administered by the organization, or in a vocational agency, the agency is helping to place people with a local company that hires a lot of people. And part of the reason they do it is that the CFO of the company is also a board member. a board member's family foundation proposes some unique and new dramatic program that might take the organization in a different direction, but conditions the gift on approval of that new direction. Every one of these obvious and simple examples raises questions. None of them should preclude the board considering approving the activity or transaction if an approval is even required, but every one of these should at least raise a red flag, provoke a discussion, and ideally, at least in part, fit into some existing policy or procedure. There we go. I think this is a key concept that I, at least in my personal experience, many nonprofit boards have not focused on adequately, which is there is this traditional concept of financial conflict of interest. And then there is something that you might refer to as disinterestedness. And one of the articles that was in the material I sent you, I think, discusses this quite well. We're not talking about economic benefits accruing to board members. Instead, we're talking about relationships that board members may have that don't create personal benefits, but may interfere with their ability to act fully consistent in a disinterested way. Common situations, and this is the one I see all the time. It applies to me as a network board member. As Ruben mentioned, I'm on three different boards. There's not a huge amount of overlap in the missions, but there's some. And board members can be board members or officers of other not-for-profit organizations. And sometimes they compete or overlap or impact the organization's fundraising, education, public policy, or other programs and services. The network is a perfect example. Our bylaws actually require that more than half of our board be made up of agency members who have activities that certainly overlap issues and that the agency, that the network is involved in. That's the whole point. But there is at least the potential for, if not conflict of interest from an economic perspective, an inability to act in a disinterested manner at the network or at the agency where there could be a conflict in development of some policy or initiative. Now it's time to step back and take 2 minutes. And I know some people who are on the phone are probably very well experienced in this, but when we talk about fiduciary obligations of directors, we're talking about three things principally. A duty of care to ensure the prudent use of all of the assets and resources of the nonprofit, people, the facility, and goodwill. A duty of loyalty, which is probably the one that comes most into question when we're talking about disinterestedness and conflicts. Directors need to ensure that the nonprofit's activities and transactions are advancing its mission. That's not particularly controversial, but they need to make decisions that are in the best interests of the nonprofit and not in the best interests of the individual board member or any other individual organization. And this can sometimes be most difficult when you're talking about corporate opportunities. For example, there's a major foundation that is offering to provide funding to a nonprofit in a particular area, particular geographic area. And you have a director that's on two boards, and each of those boards thinks that they would be the better steward of that grant. One needs to think about how to manage that, because it would be potentially awkward for a director to participate in an effort to obtain a grant that might deprive the other organization of that opportunity. And then there's a duty of obedience. We all are responsible for making sure that our organizations comply with the law, meet our stated corporate purposes and missions, and follow our bylaws. Okay, the advertising for this session talked about providing some guidance on contents of a conflict policy. Well, in addition to providing some examples, I think New York is an excellent model because it actually does spell out what is required, legally required to be in a New York conflict policy. And the memo from the Attorney General's office in New York goes into greater detail on this, and it should be of use to you even if you're not a New York nonprofit. Logically, a policy should define what circumstances constitute a conflict of interest. And I would note that if you have a chance to look at the network policy, you will see that our definition of a conflict of interest still hews fairly closely to the IRS definition, which focuses on financial conflicts. But you will also see that we've gone on to talk about the principle of disinterestedness in another way and highlighted the fact that as part of our conflicts policy, everyone on the board also needs to be sensitive to other issues which may not technically be a legal conflict of interest, but which may take away a director's ability to act in a disinterested fashion and thus needs to be addressed as part of the conflict policy. New York requires procedures for disclosing the conflict to the board or a designated committee. Recusal. A person with a conflict may not be present at or participate in board deliberations or vote on a matter giving rise to a conflict. They can be asked, in a sense, to testify or provide information, but they're not supposed to participate in the actual debate or decision. Moving further, a person with the conflict is prohibited from improperly influencing deliberation or voting. What that really means is even if a person with a conflict is not in the meeting, threatening to terminate the lease of another board member's apartment if they don't vote the right way would be an exercise of improper influence, even if they were not present in the board meeting. That's an extreme example, but the point being one can improperly influence a board when you have a conflict, even if you're not in the room. Documentation, document, document, document. What's very important in my mind for organizations in the network is to properly, through minutes or otherwise, document that the conflict was identified and how it was resolved. I think that our organizations generally are probably pretty sensitive to conflicts, but if it's not written down somewhere and somebody asks a question 2 or 3 years later, you lose some of the benefit of being scrupulous in the way that I think most of our organizations are. So either by minutes or memos to the file or other appropriate documentation, and the requirements are sometimes actually spelled out in the policy, you must document what's done. And finally, the policy should give people a process for disclosing and addressing related party transactions. And that would include, for example, who you should report to if you've got something to say. It typically also provides, most of us are now doing annual confirmations of our reviews of conflict policies and the like. All of those procedures should be in a conflict policy. Take a deep breath. We're okay on time. How to address conflicts and divided interests. I think this is the single most important thing I can communicate as part of the lesson here, which is more than anything else, it is important to create and really maintain an organizational culture that values ongoing attention to this issue. Right, it's not just something that is a policy that goes into the file cabinet. How does one do that? One does that by regularly talking about conflicts and divided interests. It comes by regularly asking in the context of a debate on what may be a sensitive issue for people to reflect on whether they have any concern about a conflict that might be created by some other activity or organization they are involved with. And of course, all of our organizations tend to take their values from the top and from leadership. And when a CEO or executive director or board chair regularly emphasizes that attention to these issues is important, boards and others, employees, will also devote attention to it without in some way feeling that it's awkward or being singled out. You want to adopt procedures that regularly remind people to focus on this subject. I think one suggestion that was made at the last network board meeting, which we thought was a good one, was for the chairman or chair of our board at the beginning of every board meeting to ask people to take another look through the agenda at the beginning of the meeting, just to think about whether there's anything on the agenda that gives them pause so that we can think about how to deal with that. And that kinds of regular procedure and sensitivity inculcates a culture that will focus on and resolve these issues in a routine way. Early identification, disclosure, and discussion is essential. None of the kinds of conflicts that I suspect or disinterested issues that we're talking about here will be disqualifying in terms of anyone being on the board. But the way to avoid problems is make sure that everybody knows about them and you address them before rather than after decisions have been made. Many of us, as I mentioned, are providing written annual confirmation that we've reviewed the conflict of interest policy, as well as updating the organization on other boards we may serve on or other agencies that we're involved with that may divide our interests or create conflicts. And you want to sense, I know many of you are leaders, but those of you who are not and who will have the opportunity to report on some of these issues within your organization, sensitizing the leadership, the organization's chair, chief executive officer, committee chairs, to be mindful of these issues when setting agendas will also go a long way, because people, when prompted to think about these issues, will almost always quickly remember if they've got anything that needs to be addressed. Confidentiality. This is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, and it comes from the fact that in the nonprofit world, I think particularly, forgive me, the nonprofit Jewish world, in which in many organizations, many of us feel that there's a social element to being on nonprofit boards, and that we like to catch up on the latest information and the latest gossip and share information, that we lose sight of the fact that confidentiality and privacy are essential. This is not an attempt to talk about HIPAA or other independent legal confidentiality obligations. I suspect there are many of you who know a lot more than I do about that subject. There is no doubt, however, that nonprofit boards develop and obtain information that must be kept confidential as a fiduciary matter. The problem here is that board members may not be adequately aware of this obligation, and they need to be sensitized. What am I talking about? And some of this, I think, was a little eye-opening to the network board, so I'd like to share it with you all as well. Agendas and minutes of board meetings are owned by the board and are confidential to the board and should not be shared outside the board without the approval of either the board or, in some cases, the board chair, depending on how the organization is run. And I would underscore that includes organizations like the network, where the network has, as I said, 51% of its board members are affiliated with agency members. When a board member sits on the board as a wearing the hat of an agency member, it does not authorize them to share the contents of agendas and minutes with their agencies. that is an independent fiduciary duty to the organization itself. Details of board and committee votes, including, for example, not only vote counts, but in a non-unanimous decision, who voted for or against a particular issue. It may be tempting to call out Mr. Smith for, you know, being the lone voice of dissent with respect to a popular program. That is confidential board information and should not be shared. And that is true even for informal discussions or opinions. Executive session details, I think most people understand, those are private to the executive session and should be, you know, again, cleared before disclosure. Any kind of personal information, not just HIPAA information, but any kind of personal information regarding other board members, staff, and in particular, donors. One of the awkward things about sitting on a board. A very generous donor becomes known to you as a board member of organization A. It may be awfully tempting to go to the fundraising director of organization B, who's never heard of this person or foundation, and say, this would be a good source of funding. I won't say that's never appropriate, but one cannot and should not do that without a lot of discussion and thought. Information about strategic plans, donor prospects, campaign strategies, and other corporate opportunities that are owned by the nonprofit can't be shared even with what may be considered kind of sister or affiliated organizations of the sort, you know, that exist between, for example, the network and its agencies, or between, for example, a federation board and local organizations that are supported by the federation and may have members of their own board who are also members of a federation board. And other non-public management or strategic documents. And I promise I'm almost done. How do you control this information? How do we avoid running into these problems? Well, adopt a confidentiality policy and discuss it and review it with the board and staff. Again, it's about sensitizing people. I think everybody we deal with, or almost everybody we deal with, is conscientious and simply needs their attention drawn to what the rules are. Whenever possible, label confidential documents as confidential. Don't make people guess about whether something that's been emailed to them or posted on a website is or is not confidential. Things like board agendas, minutes, and strategic plans should always be labeled as confidential unless the contrary is really intended. It doesn't mean they can't later be disclosed. It just means that one needs to get permission to disclose them in accordance with a confidentiality policy. In a meeting, when we're on a phone call or a Zoom meeting, when discussing sensitive or competitive matters at the board or in committee, remind the group that the information is confidential to the board or to the committee. Again, you want to make it easy for people not to make a mistake. And if there's information that we really don't want discussed outside the boardroom or the committee room, there's nothing better than taking a minute to remind everybody of that. And as with conflicts, a culture that promotes a serious attention to the subject is probably the best way to avoid many potential problems. When in doubt, board members should always be encouraged, and this applies not just to confidentiality, but to conflicts as well. Email, phone, or talk with the executive director, the CEO, or the board chair before disclosing or distributing something that might be sensitive and confidential information. I think with that, and I took a little longer than I wanted, but that's not an unusual problem for me. That provides what I would describe as a somewhat raced overview of the topic. And if Eliza or someone else can help me figure out either how to have people chime in orally with questions or comments or whatever, I'm happy to open this up and have a dialogue or whatever makes sense.
Okay. So if anyone has questions for Eric, you can type them in the...
Or disagreements or anything else. I've got pretty thick skin, so...
Right. So Eric, I'm going to start with a question, which is a little unusual, but does come up from time to time in the context of a human service agency. And I am often asked this question. And I think this might get some of those who have, signed on to this webinar to be thinking from their own perspectives and their own agencies. Our agencies increasingly are trying to be resources for the entire community. And as a result, there sometimes become situations where board members themselves have become clients or users of the service of the agency. And so I've been asked, is it best practice to avoid those situations or to, for lack of a better word, encourage or be okay with those situations? What to do when a board member becomes a client, or what to do when a family member of a board member becomes a client, a user of service?
You know, that's a really interesting and excellent question. And I will try to answer it as lawyers often do, not that it's a legal question necessarily, by analogy to the examples that you'll see, for example, in the New York State memo or that I alluded to earlier, which is a board member's kid applies for a scholarship,
right,
or for some other benefit that is offered by the agency. And while there's no bright line, generally what the materials tend to say is that not only is it not a conflict, but you don't need any kind of special board action or recusal if the quote-unquote benefit that is being accorded to the board member is being done under sort of a written set of standards and policies that apply for everybody. In other words,
right,
the board member is being taken on as a client under the client, the client intake rules.
Right, in agreement.
Same way that, your kid applies for a scholarship to a foundation, you're on the board, but the board isn't voting on the scholarship. The scholarship is being awarded by some committee applying a set of pre-existing standards, and your kid just qualifies.
Right.
So I would think that, I'm thinking about our local JFS. The JFS board itself, for obvious reasons, doesn't know who the clients are, has no input into whether or not a client should be accepted. And ordinarily, I would not think there is the slightest issue in that way with taking on a client. Then you've got the fee issue, which is a separate issue. The fee issue would be one where presumably there is a fee formula or schedule. And if those fees could be calculated, objectively by some schedule, then, again, I don't see an issue. If there was the only circumstance where one might need to at least think it through a little further, and by that I mean figure out whether you need to, touch any more bases, would be, and I find it kind of hard to imagine, the board member is somehow being offered some sort of super special deal that your average client doesn't have an opportunity to get.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And even there, it's not necessarily not allowed, but there you might need to consider some additional process, but that would be very highly fact specific. So normally I would not expect it to be a problem. Now, and sorry, I'm running on a little bit, but the other and it might well be that I would not expect the board chair or anybody on the board to even necessarily know that this board member was a client. I think the executive director or the CEO would know.
Right.
And that would put, that though puts the board member and the executive director as a fiduciary matter in a position of having to think carefully down the road. It seems unlikely, but in circumstances in which for the absolute avoidance of any, you know, potential conflict, there might be some need for the board member in question to recuse themselves. For example, it's a stop smoking program that's being offered by some family services. And the board member is desperate to stop smoking and loves the program, but is one of three people in it. And we're debating the budget, and the board is thinking about whether or not to fund it in the future. I don't think there's an obligation to disclose that they're in the program. I would say, out of an abundance of caution, and I tend to be pretty hawkish on this, I might privately say, I would step out of that discussion with no explanation. There's no obligation to explain why. I would just say, you know, as a board member, I'm going to recuse myself, go get a cup of coffee, and I'll come back.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
I see there's another question here. Yeah. How are conflict of interest issues complicated by having three or more board members that are related? That's a very good question. I guess there for a couple of observations, and I mean, some of this is personal preference rather than black letter law, and it also depends on what kind of charity we're talking about. For example, family foundations will often have multiple family members, and those on a board, and those board members still owe fiduciary duties to the foundation, but the dynamic is different than might exist for a Jewish vocational service or for the network or what have you. I generally believe that small boards should not have multiple family members. The local board that I'm on, my wife Lisa and I both had a role in organizing it and have views on how it should be run. And the way we addressed it in that situation was that one of us is legally a board member, the other is considered an honorary board member and participates in most discussions but has no vote. And the reason that we did that was that the biggest single reservation, when you ask how are they complicated, is that it's as if you've given one board member three votes when you have three people on the board. And weighted voting like that, particularly on a small board, can sometimes be awkward, if not necessarily illegal, but awkward. Even though all three people have independent fiduciary obligations, there's kind of an assumption that, you know, a husband and wife or siblings will agree with each other. Now, we all know families where that, you know, is the exception and not the rule. But I would say, how is it complicated? I think one needs to look at individual situations. It's less complicated for larger boards. The music school board that I'm on in New York City for many years had a husband and wife on the board. They got along very well. One was a lawyer, one was a professional fundraiser. They served on different committees. Both were very active on the board. There was no secret of their relationship. There was no apparent, the board was large enough that it wasn't like they were creating a voting block. Obviously, as board members, they can share confidential information with each other, the two or three people who are on the board. So I would say, and I would be interested if others have experience with other problems, but I think the biggest complication is smaller boards where essentially the two or three related board members either, you know, appear to have a larger weighted vote or carry, you know, more weight than individual board members should. But it's not neither illegal nor immoral as far as I'm concerned. It's just something to be managed. I hope that is helpful.
Are there other questions? If not, I'd love to open it up to see if anybody has an example of a conflict of interest that they were able to negotiate, manage, resolve, document, sort of sort through on their own as an example from their own agency board experience, just as a learning example for others. Does anybody have one that they would feel comfortable sharing? If so, we could unmute you. Okay. Well, again, the most popular question that I am asked is the dynamic of a client serving on one of our boards. And I think it comes up because a lot of our sister agencies, at least in the Jewish community, for example, the JCC, they often want their members on the board. A day school will often want parents of current students on the board, users, so to speak, of the service. So, you know, that's why I raise it, because it does come up in our agencies and has been a bit of a significant conflict.
It's an issue to be managed. And I think, let me give you some other examples, because for example, as I say, I'm on the board of a community music school. There was a period of time in which our organization, which will be 125 years old this year, had an absolute prohibition on parents of students serving on the board. It was viewed as a conflict. About 10 or 15 years ago, we took a more enlightened view on the theory that boards should, at some level, provide representative views of a variety of constituencies, donors, users of the service, etc. And it seemed odd, and I see Jeff has put a text in, so I'll just finish my thought and then we'll get to Jeff's text. But it seemed odd to us that we would sort of consider it automatically, you know, disqualifying. Fast forward, we now have no such limitation, and I would say at any given point, I mean, we have a board now of 28 to 30 people or so. And at any given time, we may have 4 or 5 or 6 parents. Normally, it's not disqualifying because our financial aid is administered completely independently on a blind basis. If we're debating policy, there's nothing wrong with a board member that is a parent saying, well, you know, as a parent, my perspective on this is X, Y, or Z. That's not a conflict of interest. They're not completely disinterested, but in my view, that would not preclude them from participating. I think it would be inappropriate for them to take a position based on being a parent without saying, you know, that's part of my thinking.
Sure.
It's not a bright line.
We just had one that came in from
Jeff
from JFCS Atlanta. I'm promoting you so that you could speak, so that you could do it all on your own. So Jeff, why don't you share the example with the group?
Yeah, or I can read it if Jeff is bashful or doesn't have his microphone on. That he said he's an officer on 2 boards. One organization actually rents space from the other, resolved by recusing myself from, that's fine, Jeff, I got you. Resolved by recusing myself from any discussions regarding rent, space, rent, et cetera. I'm always the last to know anything on these topics. That is a perfectly appropriate thing to do. Depending on the circumstances, that is a perfectly appropriate way of resolving that conflict. Let me go to a slightly more difficult one that is still easily resolvable, which is Jeff, instead of being on dual boards, was actually the landlord for the space. So he's on the board of an organization that wants to lease some additional space from him or from a company that's a family company. Is it permitted? Yes. Is it a conflict? Yes, it is a classic financial conflict of interest. It is one in which I would advise Jeff as a landlord to have his lawyer sort of talk to whoever handles the legal affairs for the agency to make sure it's documented properly. But there is absolutely no doubt that, although there would be more process involved, if it's a fair deal, if it's a competitive and sensible deal for the agency, if the work is done to make sure of that, and if Jeff, as the board member and landlord, is recused from any of the discussions, it is absolutely clear that that lease could be signed and would be legally binding on both parties. It's just not something that you want to do now and think about later. You want to think about it and document it first.
All right, thank you, Eric. We have just a couple minutes left for this scheduled webinar. So if there are any final questions or comments, feel free, again, in the chat or the Q&A box. And if not, I'm going to use this opportunity to again thank Eric for sharing his expertise and resources with the Affinity Group. As we noted at the beginning, the slides and the related documents that Eric referenced will be sent out to all of you immediately following today. And in addition, the recording, and we will also be hosting the material on our website for others who may want to look. And somebody just asked for the participant list. Happy to share the participant list as well. Not a problem, happy to do that.
And two other quick things, the last slide has my name and email address. I'm not legal counsel to anybody, but if there's a follow-up, that's the sort of public service announcement. But if people have been either bashful or something, as is often the case with me, occurs five minutes after you're off the phone, I do read and respond to emails and will try to provide at least some general guidance if I can. So hang on to that. And the other thing is to sort of practice what I've been preaching. I think you can, a number of the documents that I'm sending, the AICPA document, the document on disinterestedness, and the Attorney General's memo are public documents that I obtained off the web. The network policies are not public documents, but by prior conversation with Ruben, we have no problem sharing them with you or with other network members. I would be grateful not to have them posted on the internet, but otherwise within your own organizations or others that may be network involved, that would be fine. If you want to share it more broadly, just speak to Ruben about it. It won't be a problem. It's a good idea when you have documents like this to kind of have a sense of where they're going, that's all.
Okay.
Okay, can I say something? I
Absolutely.
Would just like to thank Eric. Thank you very much for your presentation. I would also like to remind everyone who's participating today that we will be trying to schedule our next webinar the second week, I think in November, like the 18th before Thanksgiving. And the last thing I would like to say is Shana Tova to everyone there, and may you have a healthy life.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy New Year, everybody. And thank you again for joining us today.
Take care. Bye, everybody.
Hi.